Welcome to another...
The official podcast of The Leaky Cauldron.
The Leaky Cauldron.
The Leaky Cauldron.
Do you hear that, Ern? The Leaky Cauldron.
Just go! You're wasting time!
Welcome to Pottercast, your number one source for news, theories, discussion and interviews with people from the Potter books and films. I know a small amount myself, having written the books. My name is J.K. Rowling. I am now happy to introduce your hosts, Melissa, John, Sue.
Hope you're not late. It's Pottercast 148. Welcome to Pottercast. Okay. How's everybody doing?
Spectacular!
It's an interesting week. We got, I'm Melissa again. I'm here with John, Sue, and Frack, and we're going to have a little guest here in a while.
Frack?
And we have a talk about this week's trial that was in New York.
With special guest, Mr. Hammer!
Mr. Hammer, stop!
Mr. Hammer? What?
We will explain that joke in a minute. We will explain this in detail in a minute.
I'm going to need that.
Can we call Mr. Hammer?
Because John is incorrigible and should not ever be in a courtroom ever again. So, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yes, Melissa and I and our special guest this week sat for every day of the trial.
Which amounted to about 24 hours of testimony.
Yes.
Which is enough to kill you.
I only left the courtroom once to get a sandwich because I was bored.
Yeah,
get
the sandwich.
I would have been there drawing them.
We wanted you there drawing so bad. Oh, well, we'll get to that too.
Okay, but first let's do our audiblekids.com thing.
This podcast is brought to you by audiblekids.com, the internet's leading source for children's audiobooks. Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Log on to audiblekids.com/podcast for more details.
Okay, what's happening besides the obvious in the world of the Harry Potter news this week?
There was a little bit of film news. We heard from actor Jim Broadbent, who plays Professor Horace Slughorn. And get this, he says he has not read the books.
Oh, no.
I know. But, I mean, let's clarify. He said he's read the first one, and now he's read the sixth book. But he is, quote,
okay.
Yeah. At least he's read, you know, about his character.
Yeah.
The character doesn't even appear before book six.
So I'm okay with that.
He's fine. You know,
he can read it because he can.
Because he can!
Oh, I forgot.
I mean, it's not like he was a major character that replaced another actor who's already done his part for 2 years and had watched the movies or read the book.
Don't know what you're talking about.
Certainly not Gambon.
You know, I mean, I give him a lot of credit for saying that. He said, I'm not a massive fan. But then he says, it's not really part of my generation, which, you know.
It's everybody's generation.
It is. Yeah. Thank you, John.
That's everybody's generation.
Yeah, but, you know. But I don't know if he realizes what he gets into when he opens, when they say, I haven't read the books. I mean, what kind of, like, people go, ah. But at least he said he read the book that he's in the movie, so that's, he gets points for that.
Well, I'd rather be honest about it than lie. So.
Yeah, that's true.
Work it.
That's really true. When
Work it. I like him. I can't wait to see his
I know.
Stuff.
I can't either. I mean, I'm dying to see what he looked like. His costumes, like, you know, his little velvety things, and I don't know.
Yeah.
Soft straw-covered hair.
Well, what else is going on, Susie?
We heard briefly, too, from actress Helen McCrory, who is filming her scenes as Narcissa Malfoy. And she's wearing couture. She's very hot couture. She said that her friend of hers is, she's a friend, and she helped design the costume. And so it's beautifully sculpted silhouette.
Cool.
I don't know. I never imagined her to be that fashionable, but I guess that makes sense. I don't know.
What do you think of the importance of the fashion for Narcissa, Frankie?
Yeah. Whenever I hear Narcissa, I think of Heather's drawing so much because she draws Narcissa so much. So whenever I read the books, I imagine that cartoon version of her.
Fan artist McKinney, I can never say it right.
Heather is
she rocks.
Awesome. I hope she gets you, John, for that.
Her artwork is
name.
Beautiful.
You should know.
What? I'm not good at pronouncing names I'm not familiar with.
I hate her because she draws things better than me, but I love her at the same time because she's so awesome.
You guys are both wonderful. Stop
it. She's amazing.
Yes, she is. I just have one more quick announcement that's important. You know that, as we reported last week, Amazon.com is having that contest to go see Beetle the Bard book in London, and Yes, and you have to write 100-word, you know, write your essay. So you haven't done it yet. It's due April 22nd, so that'll be very soon after this comes out. So hurry, hurry, hurry.
It's Tuesday. Yes. Or,
yes.
Yeah.
Or primary in Pennsylvania Day.
Yeah.
Will they accept a limerick, do you think?
You know what, John? You might get if it's 100 words or less.
I'm planning to submit my submission in the form of a limerick.
Is it?
Well, my form
you think
of
I'll win?
A fuzzy drawing of a fuzzy dog has been rejected and spat upon.
Oh.
They actually sent
it's not a
back.
Fuzzy dog, by the way. I think you're misremembering.
I'm just being told.
It's a dog in a fuzzy hat.
What did I say?
He said fuzzy dog.
A fuzzy dog.
They're pretty cute, too.
Oh, wow. We're just going to take that out of the show, then. Because...
No, we're not.
No, we're not.
That's all
hells
now.
That's funny.
That's not how we do things here,
no,
Mr. Frankie.
That ain't how we
this
do it here. No, no, no.
Oh, that's something I would say.
You didn't get editing rights yet.
What?
You're not up to editing rights. You're not up to editing rights yet. Seven shows,
one can hope.
Aw.
Oh. My God.
I don't like it. No, just one more quick say. We all say happy birthday, Emma Watson, who's now 18. Yay!
Happy birthday.
Uh-oh.
Happy birthday.
You know what that means, guys. She can buy lottery tickets in the United States.
Yep, yes, she can. I hope she needs some money. Oh, that's the other thing. All the tabloids are reporting that she, you know, her parents gave her access to her money.
Keys of the Kingdom? Is she going out buying fancy cars and dresses
and things?
No, I
think that's why they did it, to show that she's not that girl. So it's going to be fine.
Wow.
Yay for her.
Let her spend her money, whatever.
You know, I mean, if Rupert can buy an ice cream truck, she can go buy whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Isn't Rupert like 19 now or something? Or 20?
How
old is Rupert?
He's older now.
He's the oldest of the trio. And then is it Dan or is it Emma? Because Dan's 18, right?
Dan and then Emma.
Right.
She just turned 18.
Almost positive.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's great. That's great. What happened? I mean, it's funny. People get all touchy about Emma, but she's basically, imagine if you were her and you could be a teenager and have unlimited access to like clothes and you know, and your social life. Let her have fun with it, God. You're only a teenager once.
It's true.
But yeah, I mean, she's being smart, and when she's good, but still, I mean.
And honestly, it balances out, because the freedom she has financially, she lacks socially, because of her, you know, being who she is. Like, things people don't have as easy as walking around. You know, they can't enjoy certain things that regular people can enjoy.
No, they do not.
So it's just, it's kind of it's a balance.
Yeah.
No.
So what else happened this week, Melissa?
Oh, gee, let me think. For those who have been following, the case of J.K. Rowling and Warner Brothers versus RDR Books went to trial this week in Manhattan Federal Court. John and I and our friend Sam, who
is coming over here right now,
is total coincidence because John has just graduated school and he was going to be up here this week anyway, and the trial just landed right in the middle of it, so he wanted to go to it as well. He didn't come up here to gawk at Joe the way we were saying. And people, and you know what? Not many people did. There were only a handful of non-lawyer, non-party people in the courtroom.
That's
actually
refreshing to hear.
Couple people I had no idea who they were.
Yeah.
So I assume they were just fans. I don't know.
Well, let's introduce our guest of the segment. This is Sammy. Or Sam. Sam Friedman.
Sam? Why, hello.
Frack!
Miss Sam.
Well, some of you might know her as the one who is yet to be smarter than John Noe on the Smarter Than John Noe segment.
All right, whatever you say.
She is also a snook, and she was also here for all 3 days.
She's also Sam Friedman, garlic bread haver.
Oh my gosh, Breck, I got it, by the way. Okay, I'm sorry,
not
the time.
Okay, we'll do that after.
Yeah,
anyway, I'm not going to say all that much about this because, as some of you know, there was an email of mine that was used during testimony, and so I don't think, I'm not going to be giving information on like a leaky channel. I may, you know, I can say things personally, but I just don't think it's right to start, to report on something that is technically a news source. So, there are a couple things I can talk about, but I'm not going to really discuss the details of the case. I'll leave that to John and Sam.
Well, you don't have to, you know, I mean, I think people might just be curious to hear about how it all played out because it was
like the semantics,
you know, 3 days of stuff. It almost feels like we're doing a set report here, but it's...
I know.
I wish it was.
On hard benches, and it was really long.
The costumes were spectacular.
Absolutely fantastic.
Now, was Hagrid's hut in the same spot, or was it a different hut?
Hagrid's hut. You know, it was very minuscule. It was in the jury box.
Oh, nice.
They shrunk it down. Well, let's start, I guess, towards the beginning. Like Melissa said, there was hardly anybody there, which is surprising because it was all too easy to just go in as a regular civilian person. We were surprised that when we walked in the first day.
We got there so early.
We got there hours early.
Oh, early.
I expected to have to knock out some fans, to be honest.
You think they'd be camping out?
Don't they know who we are?
What?
I brought my expired press pass, and just in case, you know, because sometimes people don't really look closely, and then, you know, I can get in just in case that was the only way, but it was totally not the only way.
Yeah, it probably would have been against a law of some sort.
Nah, not really.
Nah.
It's not. It's
she's so pressed.
It's just a matter of policy. It's having a pass doesn't make you press.
So first to testify.
First to testify was the lovely, ever lovely Miss Jo.
She's so beautiful.
I just gotta say, it's really funny because when she gets called up, like everybody in the room sits up and it's like, oh my god, there she comes. You know, you could feel it. But that was why all this press was there. That was why, you know, obviously.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is that probably the biggest contingent of people that were there was people from Scholastic. They took up like the first two or three rows.
Like 10 to 12 people from Scholastic.
Pretty much
there every day.
We were sitting right behind them, and it was pretty cool. It was like the who's who of the Scholastic seniors.
Was Arthur there?
Arthur Levine was there last day too.
Wow. Ooh.
Yeah. See, I didn't know that. Why didn't anybody point him out?
The funniest thing about that though is that they mentioned Flint, which are errors in the books, and Arthur like looked scandalized. It was so funny.
They mentioned what?
Flints, which are it's a fan term for an error.
Oh, I was unaware of that. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there was a character called Marcus Flint, and a long time ago we discovered that he appears in book 3 when he really should have graduated.
Oh, I remember that. Okay. I didn't realize his last name.
Yeah, and so they call him Flint.
Nice.
Yeah.
Flint.
He has awful teeth.
Yeah, I like it.
As seen awful in teeth
from the movie.
I thought he was hot.
In the movie?
He's gorgeous in real life. Right. If you've seen him without his teeth in, let me just say, he's a good-looking man. Okay.
That's what I've heard. I've heard that.
Oh. Same with Matt Lewis.
Who? The actor who plays him in the movies. He's one of my MySpace friends.
Interesting.
Sorry. Okay. Let's go along. Tara, go.
Well, one of the interesting things to point out is that while Joe was first to testify, each side here had at least 5 lawyers. The RDR side and the Joe Warner Brothers side. And one thing to point out as well, just to remind everybody, the RDR side does not include Steve. He was there as a witness, not actually named in the suit or anything, because from what I understand, his publishing contract indemnified him from any form of litigation or suits arising from complaints of Joe or Warner Brothers specifically. So he was there as a witness. And additionally, what was it called? He was not allowed to even be in the courtroom during Joe's testimony.
It was a sequestration order. Sequestration. It was sequestered.
I wanted to ask you about that. Can we talk about that? Because the second day, he was in the courtroom with Joe, and that was like a big shock to everybody. Or was
it the third day?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
including
there for his testimony too.
Yeah,
Joe was there while he testified.
Right, and that's why I was really shocked because I didn't know, I wasn't there, and I was like, whoa, when I read that she was there.
They asked if the sequestration order should have been lifted, and the judge said it was fine, and that he should have been in right after his own testimony. He should have been, but he wasn't until the third day. And Joe, at that point, Joe was a rebuttal witness. You bring somebody back up to refute.
Was he there for that? I know he was there during closing arguments, but I don't know if he was there for Joe's second testimony. Was he?
No. Well, thank you for clarifying that, because I just didn't understand what was happening there. So.
I don't know why. I mean, I understand why, but I don't know exactly why.
So what was that like when Joe came up? I mean, that must have just been awesome.
I don't know that awesome's the right.
I mean, just kind of.
I mean, it was definitely cool to see her again.
Yeah.
But one something we could tell from the beginning was, especially as soon as she started testifying, was how she came all the way out here because she was very, you know, intensely passionate about the issues at stake. And it was, it,
she made an art right away to be something bigger than just her books and her case. That it was something
awesome.
That a case that would affect all other authors, present and future, and protecting their own work. So she was very there. She was very businesslike, but she was 100% the likable Joe that we all know too. Which, oh god, the RDR side's main lawyer for oral arguments.
Are we going to explain this now?
Because we have to.
Okay.
His name is Mr. Hammer.
Oh, Mr. Hammer.
And
so disrespectful. I can't even get over it, but it was so funny.
Mr. Hammer is this old man, and
he's not old.
He has hardly any hair left. He's aging bald-ish man. But I'm pretty sure he is a professor at Stanford. And we all know that a group from Stanford, all about fair use and that kind of thing, got involved with RDR some time ago, and were there pretty much. I couldn't tell in what capacity they were there. Some of their lawyers were directly in that group. Some of them were just acquaintances, I thought, from Stanford. But anyway, I don't think Mr. Hammer specifically was in that actual fair use group.
No, he's not from the fair use project. No.
But the fun thing about him.
So he's not a gavel.
Nah.
No.
I like what you did
there,
friend.
Honestly, that's what I thought it was.
He has appeared as such in the following, the cartoons that were drawn following by
cartoons.
Please explain this before everybody thinks we're the worst people in the world.
We will explain
this.
Because it's nothing just other than us trying to amuse ourselves in 24 hours of testimony. During the cross-examination, when Mr. Hammer was questioning Joe about things, Joe was very polite and liked to address the people guessing her questions by their name after every response she makes.
Mm-hmm.
So Mr. Hammer would be all like, et cetera, et cetera, Joe. And then she'd be like, well, Mr. Hammer, you must understand this. And every time she would talk to him, she would say, Mr. Hammer.
Hammer.
So it just had to be this funny thing. We just kept going.
Except John killed the joke in that every 8 seconds he's like, Mr. Hammer.
No, it's still funny.
Yeah, to you. I'm over it.
Funny.
Oh, Mr. Hammer.
Yeah, I'm
But should we tell her the funniest part of this already? We're jumping all around on this.
Well, the funniest part is that later when the hallway, I was trying to do my Rubik's Cube, and Joe came down the hall. They were coming back from lunch. And so she beckoned to her people that she was going to come over. So we, did hugs and whatever. And John repeated what he had been repeating all day. This is the second day now. Just goes, Mr. Hammer.
At some point.
Right to her face.
Imitating her own voice right to her face.
No.
And she starts laughing and says, John, don't make it sound like I'm juicing him.
Because I have no control over my British accent as far as what emotion comes from.
Oh, my God.
So,
no.
You should have seen Joe's face, though. She was like, what?
So I'm like, oh, it's like, John. Oh, Mr. Hammer.
Oh, my
and she's
gosh.
Like, it's like, oh, you make it so seductive.
Oh, no. It was very funny.
Mr. Hammer.
No, but nobody was there to seduce Mr. Hammer, certainly. Everybody,
I would take him out after the trial.
Everybody during court was very, respectful to Mr. Hammer.
But you have to understand, you're sitting in that courtroom, and sometimes the testimony is riveting, and sometimes the testimony is a matter of waiting for the technology to go on the screen, and do you see this? Is this an email you recognize? Tell me where you grew up. Are you sure? And it's, and it can get very, very long and boring. So what you do, you start drawing. And so once John started saying, Mr. Hammer, all the time, we started drawing hammers.
Hammer, we all had notebooks, and the hammers would have arms and legs and hair and
hair
expressions.
And
he doesn't
have
any hair.
Well, he had parts of hair.
Little fuzz.
Hammers for hands.
Hammers.
So it just became like the way we sort of got through the more drudging parts of the.
So can I ask you this? I mean, on the first day, or when Joe testified, and when I met by awesome, that just must have been emotional, powerful moments to see.
Absolutely.
Coming up. And then we, the press reports came out, and it was just, some of it was very scattered, and Joe, the big headline was Joe cried. I mean, was that an emotional moment for you guys without getting to what the details of it? I mean, what was that like for you guys?
Well, as soon as she did it, all I thought was, oh, dear God, the headlines tomorrow, that's all they're going to be. Or the headlines right now, because once we took a break, journalists literally ran out of the room, and I'm sure had files within an hour, because you're in there, you have no electronic equipment.
Yeah.
You can't, so they have to run out, tell their editors, they have to, and the way the news cycle is now, you have to get it online. So I knew as soon as we left that the story had been up.
Are you allowed to say, like, why? Or?
Sand. Like, that was it. And they, I think maybe they glossed over, you know, why she was crying. I just want to clear up this whole recusing thing. There's no law that says I can't talk about it. Nobody's asked me not to talk about it. It's nothing like that. I just don't feel it's proper to do what I would call impartial reporting work. I don't think the commentary on generally what was happening reporting work or would be perceived
as anything,
you know, but the details.
You have more ability to give commentary now that you don't have
to be probably right.
Concerned with impartial reporting.
You're right. Commentary is probably, I just am a little, you know, a little jumpy because this is a really, really, it was emotional for everybody and for some very personal reasons.
Yeah.
For
me, and I'll just come out right here.
Yeah.
This is a Harry Potter podcast, and we are all fans of Joe, first and foremost. And I can say with quite a bit of certainty that the people involved with this trial that have the interests of the fans at heart is the side of Joe and Warner Brothers. So there is no, you guys can take from this what you want. We're just going to tell you what happened. But I'm not concerned with, you know, hurting feelings at this point. Because what came out of that trial came out of that trial. So we're just going to tell you what we saw and what was said that was of interest. And, what, you know, eventually that'll all be online anyway, so.
Yeah, it will in transcript form. So many, 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 many pages.
Yeah. So Joe came up there, and the beginning part of the testimony was pretty much just a brief, you know, about her kind of section. One of the things that they seemed to be important for them to get out was that regardless of how successful Joe has been, and of how much money she, you know, deservedly has earned from all of this stuff. She's still an author like any other author, and she still should have the same rights as any other author. And at one point, she was, you know, struggling, just like any other author starting out. So they painted the same picture with a story that we're all used to hearing about Joe and how she started out and, you know, had struggled to come up with money to feed herself and Jessica and that whole story. And so when she was asked, you know, what Harry Potter meant to her, what the characters meant to her, it's a loaded question because we know what this means to her, and it's very, very deep. So it brought out some heavy emotions.
Yeah. I don't know how Joe acquired this very nice speaking voice, because she's very, very clear in what she says. So I think that was why some of the people in the court reacted the way they did. She has, aside from even being a writer, she just formulates her thoughts wholly.
Yeah, good way.
There's rarely any ambiguity to it. So it was a really captivating kind of thing, not just because she was Joe. So there were emotions. I mean, it was just like a really pressurized couple hours. You know, with her on the stand.
Yeah, most definitely. She is so articulate, and it's like the trial had more than a couple witnesses that were easy to snooze at, and Joe definitely held everybody's attention, especially the judge. And I think that she did really well that first day.
The defense's job is with any witness, is to get somebody to say things to discredit their own testimony, their own first testimony, or to at least work towards their side. And Joe, just more than anybody else throughout the trial, just was not having it. And it wasn't that she even said no or I don't know or something to certain things. As you've seen in the transcript, she usually had something like, you know, is that the best you can say? It has text. You know, she always had something that seemed to further her point instead of just allowing herself to be led down the path.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, definitely. And it's funny because it's frustrating. It was frustrating for us as fans so familiar with all of this to sit there and listen at some points because it's like there's so much that, you know, it seemed like.
It was frustrating.
Yeah, it didn't even, not everything even came up, or they'd start to address points and then they'd. Yeah, there'd be an objection, or they'd step off of them, without really hitting it. And that just may be because us as fans, you know, are very familiar with everything to do with Harry Potter, especially people who do podcasts about it and listen regularly. But, like, there were some things where, you know, they'd be like, one of the entries that they were comparing the where it appeared in the books to where it appears in Steve's book was about Bertie Bott's Every Flavor Bean.
Oh, my gosh.
And Mr. Hammer was trying to refer to the beans, and he's like, what was that, Bertie Bott's Desserts, Licorice Factory, whatever it was. It's like, dude, it's like, you want to talk about this stuff?
At that moment, though, everybody at Scholastic just looked at each other in disgust, like, who are you?
And, like,
everybody, it was really funny sitting behind the people from Scholastic, I have to tell you.
And Draco Malfoy.
Yeah, I was just going to say Draco and Voldemort. Voldemort.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. No, Draco, when he said that, I drew a little vampire, Draco Malfoy.
Yeah. We got really into the drawings at that point.
Yeah, day three, we have pages of drawings.
And it's funny because at one point, and now Joe thought that this was us, by the way, and she had to be told that it was her lawyer.
Yeah.
There was a point where an expert for RDR was saying, she had said in her declaration, which is the document that you produce, she had said that she knew that C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien were under copyright when guides were written about them, right? And then they asked her if she knew, and she's an expert in so many gabillion ways in literature, and they asked her if she knew that whether Shakespeare was under public domain, which he is. And I would think if you come anywhere near an English degree, mm-hmm. you know that. And she said, I don't know. Yeah. Oh. And literally the two rows of Scholastic people were shaking their heads as one.
Yeah.
And because it was like, what? You know, it was very, nobody could believe, I don't think anybody anyway, could believe that was said. And she said it a couple times. And Mr. Hammer was like looks back and goes, you know, Judge, can we instruct the people over here not to be so, you know, enthusiastic? Maybe they do it that way in England or something. So he got real, real, real.
Might I add, there was only one English person
at times
over there.
And who was American, who had just been living in England
lawyer.
For 15
no, no,
years.
No.
Oh,
Joe's lawyer, Neil,
Neil
was there. He's British. But, right. He's American. Yeah. He's the lawyer for RDR.
Yeah.
Now, what was Warner Brothers' role in the trial? Were they just there, were they called up, too, or were they just more, like, for support because they had...
They were plaintiffs.
No...
But they didn't have anybody up.
No. Okay. So it probably would have been helpful for David Heyman to have been there at one point. But
Daddy Heyman.
I agree.
But anyway, the first day was Joe and the publisher for RDR, Roger Rappaport, mm-hmm. I believe his name is. And that was a little more complicated testimony than Joe's. A lot of it was going through the how he met Steve and what the communications were with them from when they met and to up until publishing. And one of the points that they were really trying to stress for some reason was how fast they tried to get the book together. I think at one point they said that they wanted to put the whole manuscript of the book together in 2 weeks. And it was part of a line of questioning and an argument to make that because the book was rushed so much that its quality suffered from that.
Which only is apparently relevant because there is an argument being made by their side that it is a useful tool for people, so then you to argue against that, it's on quality. But then they argued in their closing that it's not about quality. So
it is a very confusing thing because they spent a lot of time and a lot of testimony and a lot of effort, and even a whole expert witness for Joe's side was somebody to testify about the quality and how the book isn't up to par with what the academic standard for a resource or ready reference guide would be. And they make the whole point about the quality, and Joe even talked a lot about the quality and how she thought it was, you know, dreadful, pretty much.
Now, can we get on to that point? Can I just, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but this was actually pretty well discussed, and I'd really like to hear your opinion. What does she mean? Do you mean the book itself or the whole lexicon itself was not good?
She was talking about the book at this point.
Okay.
And she did also address her thoughts on the website, in that she
She acknowledged the time involved in putting it together
okay. And
the effort, and she justified her fansite award as especially the blurb when she was asked about the blurb, because that was a pretty big thing.
Yeah.
That was RDR's argument, was like, look, she said it's a good site and
right. This
and that, but she said that, you know, when she was asked specifically, when did you go into an internet cafe to look something up, what did you look up? And she's like, well, I don't remember why I looked up, but I went to the lexicon specifically so I could say I went to the lexicon. I could have just as easily Googled the information. But she wanted to go to lexicon to say that she has, so she could acknowledge it, because she looked at Steve as a fan who was putting in an obsessive amount of work and was a very enthusiastic fan and wanted to try to acknowledge that. But to suggest anything more like Joe needed the lexicon to write the books is that was an argument that they tried to make about Warner Brothers and EA as well.
Right.
That they needed the lexicon to do all that stuff. And
didn't she say she gave the fansite award specifically for, what did she say, A for effort?
An A for effort.
More than the fact that it was a good site.
Yeah.
Well, it's just one of those situations that, like, if this trial didn't come about, it wouldn't be anything she'd ever have to discuss in such a candid manner. But the fact that she can't, I guess pull punches is the wrong term, but for lack of a better one, but I would imagine, like,
well,
the fact that like, forever, she doesn't want to go around saying that, because it's, you know, but...
Well,
but
I mean, she's getting called out by Steve saying, oh, well, this must mean that you needed me. And that's, I mean, he invited that on himself.
RDR, too.
Yeah. Well, it takes a certain kind of personality to inflate yourself every opportunity to be bigger than you are, and to take a comment that I was in earshot when he asked David Heyman if he knew of the lexicon, to turn that into, well, we use it every day and yeah, it's great, that was absolutely not what he said, and just to hear that kind of stuff come up in a court of law is just wow. It's like there's a lot that just did not add up.
Another thing she talked to about the fan section, she doesn't want to censor us. And I thought that was really important that she said that, you know?
Yeah.
No, she really does not.
And but you know, that did come up in the testimony, though, mm-hmm. where she said, you know, I'm not in the business of censoring or suppressing anything. And my books are on the tops of all the banned books lists. And, you know, I'm all for not, you know, I am definitely against censorship. And to suggest otherwise is ludicrous, but you know she did you know say you know I'm worried the result of this case could change her stance on what's allowed in the online fandom. She said that you know maybe I was naive to think that because I was so flexible with all of this that I might have somehow lessened my copyright. And I think a verdict in RDR's direction would basically reinforce that point of view.
You know, it's so nice to hear you guys say that, because it's so hard to convey. I mean, you can write down factually what transcript, what the word by word is, but to convey
right.
the emotion that's, and then has how it's delivered and the nuance and the tenor of it, it's such a different, especially to something like to us, that it matters so hugely. That's nice.
Yeah.
And that's especially, so I'm glad you said that, because that's especially, I mean, what we're trying to do on the main site is not what every other news outlet does, that they send somebody and that person interprets it. And I understand why you have to do that, because you cannot cover the scope of this case in a 600 to 800 word article. You need to publish something that the average reader is just going to read. So then somebody comes in and they make a judgment. And when you write something like that, you're making all these judgments. It's necessary. And that was something we completely 100% totally didn't want to do. So that's why whatever we posted on Leaky is just this person said, this person said, this person was asked, this person said. And literally those notes, I mean, John, what percentage of time was I writing while we were in the courtroom?
You filled up notebooks.
My wrist.
One and a half notebooks.
It still hurts right now. I'm pressing on it. It was bloated.
Really?
It's like, you know, so it's literally, I'm sure I missed things. I'm sure I got things wrong. But you just keep going, and there's like a cadence to it. You just do it as fast as you can, and you get whatever you can. And every bit that's in my notebooks that I could then
see while I was, you know, transcribing, because my handwriting is pretty disgusting, then, you know, went up on. So we tried as hard as I honestly think it is for a person to try, as much as we could have possibly done to take that making judgments process out of the news posting. So this is more of a commentary.
Sorry.
Now, this isn't a jury trial.
No, there's no jury.
No. Like, how will a verdict be reached? Like, just because I'm really
naive. No, that's a good question. The judge will be getting briefs on May 9th. They have to file briefs. I guess it's a civil trial procedure. They have to file briefs, and the judge will look them over. He told them, do it sooner is better, because as soon as I get into another case, I put all my energy into another case, like he's telling them, I'm going to forget, you know. So he has to, they have to submit briefs, and then he'll make a ruling. So who knows, actually.
The issue with the judge, one of the stories that's out right now is how he was urging for a settlement, which was something that he kind of sprung on everybody at the end of the second day of the case. And I don't know if this is normal. I heard it might be, but
I heard it.
But it seemed like, oh my gosh, we're sitting here, we have all these people out here for this. This has been a trial that's had months leading up to it. You want to spring that on everybody the second day of the trial? I mean, pretty much cutting off one of the testimonies of one of the witnesses up there to say all this. I was like, I couldn't believe it, because where is there grounds for settlement? I don't know, just from being there, from knowing anything. I don't know anything privileged, certainly, but it's like either the book comes out or it doesn't. Either a book can't. The only thing I could possibly think is that they could go into rewrites and they could.
They would have to rewrite the entire book.
Yeah, they would have to rewrite the entire book. I mean, one of the bits of evidence that didn't make it into the trial was the pie chart that's been online everywhere now and made into avatars and all that.
Kind of doom.
I mean, there's really no reason to believe that that's inaccurate.
I'm unaware.
Facts unaware. Can you explain?
But basically, how most of the testimony worked was the witnesses submitted long documents explaining, you know, their views and their stance on a lot of the issues of the case. And then while they were on the stand, the lawyers referenced those documents and, you know, they basically couldn't talk about anything that wasn't in evidence already, which I didn't quite understand that process, but I understand it now. And one of the bits of evidence for one of the expert witnesses, I think her name was like Dean Johnson or something.
Jerry Johnson. Senior tutor,
This
has gone over many times in the courtroom.
But she actually counted every single line in Steve's book and categorized it as either directly lifted from Joe's without any citation or word for word or small paraphrasing, and the other lines in the book, which were either made up, the etymology of words, meanings, cultural references, geographical references, other things that...
Or adverbs.
Or adverbs. Anything that wasn't, you know, essentially taken from Joe. And she made the big list, and they put it into a pie chart. And that pie chart has been online. And it's just amusing because, you know, I think it was something like 91% of this book, of the lines from this book, are direct quotes from the Harry Potter books or the companion books or other bits of Joe's property. And for some reason, the actual chart didn't make it into evidence for whatever reason.
Well, here's why. And Jerry Johnson told me this, so take this with whatever that means. In order to streamline the procedure, because at the end of when the judge settled, the judge was indicating that everything was taking far too long, they were going to call her and RDR's expert witness, and then either one of them would be a rebuttal as well. Jerry Johnson was made into just a rebuttal, so they can condense her testimony into just her rebuttal, so they didn't have to go through the whole process twice.
I didn't know that, and I was there.
And once she was, once she was made just a rebuttal, she couldn't introduce anything new. She could only respond to what she said.
Okay.
So she couldn't talk about it.
That's interesting.
It's crazy, the subtleties of a law like that. Wow.
Oh, yeah, and they objected at every opportunity they could to stifle any new information. It was so annoying.
Yeah.
That's so frustrating. Yeah. That's the wrong. It's like a loophole rather than like a legitimate reason as to not, you know, it's like, it's not the fact that it's incredible, like, it's not credible information. It's just the fact that, like, it's going to hurt us, and technically we're not allowed to say it, so we'll make them not say it. Oh, that's frustrating.
Well, that's, you know, their job, I guess.
It's just,
yeah,
it's just, yeah, it's nature of the beast.
But, so,
Well, day two, right? Well, we haven't really discussed Steve coming, right, have we?
Well, day two was Steve, and it was, I think, what they called an expert witness on publishing. And it was also, I think, Susan Murphy, I believe, from Scholastic. Suzanne Murphy.
Yes.
But Steve was up to bat first. It was interesting. I don't know where to begin on that.
I'm not gonna.
They did the same sort of procedure like they did with Joe in doing a brief history. Talked about how he got into, you know, Harry Potter. I think he said it was like 1998 maybe. Mm-hmm. And how he had read books one and books two, and he took notes on them as he was reading them. And eventually those notes, as he continued reading, was at some point turned into the website format he called the Harry Potter Lexicon. And they just basically told the story of his site and how it was developed and how eventually other people came on to help and edit and this and that. They talked about when he had decided it might be useful to turn to a book.
Oh, okay.
And you know, and they brought up letters that were introduced into evidence where he had previously told people, well, one of the purposes of the lexicon is so people don't have to write a book, because I believe that to be Joe's right. And that was what a lot of people thought to be a pretty big damning evidence, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they had made the argument that Steve, as a layperson, not a lawyer, or somebody with any knowledge of the law, wasn't really capable of making that kind of judgment. So that whole argument was sort of tossed, or not.
Except for
there was a line of questioning about some evidence that Joe's site had found where Steve had posted in web forms, and all of us know about web forms, where it's pretty funny trying to explain to the judge and Mr. Hammer what web forms were.
He didn't know what a form was?
He couldn't understand, like, how the they showed a piece of paper that was clearly, there was a quoted piece of another post and then the actual post underneath, and he, like, didn't get how they were it was the original post and the answer in the same document.
Yeah, and
you know?
That was the funny part, because it's like, you're only allowed to talk about the exact bit that you have tossed into evidence, and so they had basically a few threads of that whole big conversation on that Newton site. The Newton site was about, I guess, an old computer system called the Newton, and it was a topic about sharing books and whether or not it was legal to copy books to be read on the Newton with other people. And Steve had said on that this would not be legal.
It's almost ironic that he just happened to post in a copyright thread online. How long ago was it? Like 10 years?
Yeah.
8 years?
8 years. 2000 and 2003.
Yeah, it was a while ago. And It got all very, very confusing, and lots of hoops were being jumped in and out of here. But I don't know if that particular testimony was helpful regarding the Newton stuff. But the stuff everybody's talking about right now regarding his testimony was the point where he started to cry.
Yes,
I have very strong feelings about this. You can intro it, I guess.
Well, the question he was asked was, I believe he was asked, originally he was asked, what is the Harry Potter community? Or, you know, what is the fandom, essentially? And he explained, you know, it's a group of fans, you know, really, really big Harry Potter fans that choose Harry Potter and things related to it as one of their major hobbies. And, you know, how they like to hang out with each other and talk online and this and that. It was funny, just looking left and right of me at Sam and Melissa. It's like, had come to trials about Harry Potter together. And pretty funny.
Yeah, John just nudged me and was like, it's us.
Yeah. but then he was
Exhibit A.
Yeah, exactly.
Sam Friedman, yeah.
So then he was asked, are you a part of the Harry Potter community? And his answer, I think, was, I used to be.
No, I did.
I did.
I did.
And
do you feel you're a part of the Harry Potter community?
And then, you know, it brought some emotion out of him. And there was some strong feelings regarding this.
Well, it was when, do you still feel part of this community? And then he was all like, you know, quiet. But I'm not going to accuse him of fake crying. I believe he was definitely emotional. But Any hardcore Harry Potter fan could have sat up there, asked that question. I would have started sobbing if they were just saying, hey, I want some candy. How do you feel about Harry Potter? And I would start crying on Trial or Not.
No.
That was a really bad example.
No, I get it. I get what you mean.
I know what you mean. No, it was a really
hard
thing.
It's tough. It's tough to have the opinion on this because it was the first point, I think, of the whole testimony where I did start to remember, you know, all of the stuff we used to do with Steve and, you know, being at the conventions and doing the show and everything. And it's when it gets murky to separate those kind of feelings from everything else. But what I walked away with from this case and from what happened, at least from what the facts that came out in the case was, is that it's the story of somebody wanting to write a book about Harry Potter, you know, in face of, you know, Joe, basically against Joe's wishes, and, you know, as a Harry Potter fan, strictly as a Harry Potter fan, if you proceed in doing that, challenge her, go to court over it, challenge her in court, and try to fight against her right to have a copyright, go up against her like that, as intense as they did, I can't feel bad for you if you're crying about not feeling like you're part of the Harry Potter fans anymore, because I am of the belief that a true Harry Potter fan who's in this, who's in to enjoy the fandom with other Harry Potter fans, to be a part of the community, is going to actually have some respect for the author of this fandom.
What I want to know is how you can sit on the bench and Joe Rowling is 6 feet in front of you and just testify that you have every right to write this book. And Joe is in full support of that, but she just wants him to rewrite it so that it's not her exact words for 91% of the book.
Yeah, and you know, she wants that because of what it would do, what it would change for the fandom, what it would change for the precedent it would set.
Authors.
For other authors, for her. I mean, if this case goes in favor of RDR, the Lexicon could be the first in many books to do the exact same thing. To the Harry Potter books and to Joe and to any other author, and like they mentioned in some other testimony, in term papers, reports.
That's what Joe said, which
completely true. It's a matter of how much is fair for you to take from somebody that's work that's copyrighted and pass it off as yours
without quotations.
Can we be clear about the taking and the copying and the quotation and what it means?
You know, standard citations, MLA formats and whatever the format was in UK, you know, states that you have to accurately cite where you're taking things from. And in the lexicon, there is next to no use of quotation marks at any point in any of these entries. And that was one of the arguments that they were trying to really talk about, was that how can a reader tell the difference between what is exactly Joe's word-for-word stuff and what was added by any of the supposed authors of the lexicon book? And there's no way to tell. And that was one of the things that really bothered Joe.
And where there should be book and page number, there was simply book and chapter number and no specification whether it was the UK edition or the US edition.
Jerry Johnson talked about that and how they teach high school students to do this, that you pick an edition and you say which edition you're using, or you cite both editions, or you cite, you know, and because the pagination, the judge had asked about this, is the pagination is different in America and Britain. And she said, well, yes, if you either cite both or you provide a chart at the back or you just tell them which edition you're using, or, you know, there was a lot of discussion
around
that.
And one of the things that, you know, RDR tried to say that, you know, the reasons it was okay was because a lot of times, say you're describing an entry on the room of requirement, for instance. It wasn't in the evidence, but I'll take that as an example. In the lexicon, you could find the entry for the room of requirement, and it could say something like, Dumbledore says, and then a quote from the books directly on the room of requirement. And the argument is, to start the sentence out as a character says, then that should make it, you know, obvious to a reader that it's from the book, even though there's no quotation marks of any kind. And where I think that breaks down is, you could just as easily have Dumbledore says, and then give your a completely freshly worded, you know, view of what Dumbledore said about the room of requirement.
Or like a paraphrase or synopsis versus like a direct quote.
Well, that's what I do. I do that on Leaky all the time. And you do that in stories and you do that in anything written. If I say, according to Mr. Radcliffe, the movie will be shot over 3 months. But if Dan Radcliffe said, yeah, I think we're going to make it in about 3 months, it would be like, according to Mr. Radcliffe, comma, quote,
exactly.
Yeah, I think we're going to make it
and
in 3 months.
And there's no way
period.
Without quotation marks to tell the difference of what, of whether Melissa had said, you know, Dan Radcliffe said it'll be 3 months, or, yeah, I think we're going to do it in 3 months.
Right. That's just basic journalism. We do that all the time. It's amazing. I knew that like in school though. I mean, I was taught that in school.
Yeah.
Like my son's like in fifth grade and they're learning how to write papers and you put the quotes in.
Exactly.
That's what Jerry Johnson said. And that's why I'm completely confounded by the reports that her testimony wasn't good. I heard people twittering about her testimony when they left the courtroom. Which is just, you know, it's because she was the one talking about it. She said, this is what we learn in school. You know, you don't have to do it just in journalism. You can't say this is not journalism. I would think it would have even stricter being a reference book or something that's supposed to be of use, you know, I don't want to personally, I've taken me a long time to be able to say this about myself, but I'm a writer now. I work as a writer. Because I'm a journalist doesn't mean I don't work in imagery. And sometimes when I'm trying to explain something, I have to sit here and think for maybe 10, 15 minutes about what a particular image looked like in my mind and how to best communicate it. And those are the things that are reproduced in that book. And I don't feel there's there's this whole brain room thing with the movie images, and I think that's a prime example. Joe was talking about how the movie, you know, she thought for a long time to describe it like a film strip with movie images coming out of the back, like the brains from the brain room, and that is reproduced. And the argument was that, well, there was no other way we could have said that, and I, off the top of my head, can say it was like a string coming out of a balloon. It was like a string coming off of a yo-yo. Mm-hmm. It was like a streamer hanging from a chandelier. I can think of 10 things if I sat here at a different to describe a different way to talk about it. It's absolutely not necessary to take her imagery. And so that, as a writer, speaking apart from everything else, is a part
they
that's
asked
really
somebody to
upset.
Word something that was taken from the Harry Potter books differently. Was it to you? They asked him to re-describe something in his own words, and he was able to do it. Yet in the lexicon manuscript, it was her exact words.
Yeah, and that's the funny thing, too, is that if you want to go out and you say you're an authority about Harry Potter and you want to give definitions of stuff, you're somebody who is able to say, oh, what's a bludger? I could tell you what a bludger is. I don't need to open up the book and copy word for word what Oliver Wood says about the darn bludgers. I could tell you what it is. But in almost every instance, they chose to take word for word how Joe, or a character in Joe's books, describes the entry in question. And that is the biggest thing that Joe took issue with, is that why the hell did you need to do that when you so easily could have just given your own definitions? Instead, you plagiarized my work.
So maybe you don't want to answer this, but I have known Steve for many, many, many years. And we've worked with him, like you said, John. But did you feel that any of his testimony gave any credence to what he was trying to do with his side? I mean, if you're just being an impartial person, did you feel that he was doing a good job up there at all? I meant
doing a good job of articulating his opinions on the stuff. I mean, yeah. I mean, especially his lawyers asked, you know, all the questions that would, you know, most productively get that side out. And I mean, they even asked, you know, it's like, what do you think of Harry Potter and what do you think of J.K. Rowling? And, you know, the answers were, you know, like, oh, she's a genius, I respect her, and everything else. It's like the words would say the one thing. It's just, you know, all of the actions of this case and all of the actions of making the book that he did and all of the actions of forcing it like this speak the opposite. They speak, I don't respect you or what you've done. I think I am entitled to this money and to this book, and I will take you, you know, I will stand in court and say it. So that's, you know, that's again why I couldn't feel sad at the crying about not feeling like you're part of this community anymore, because I think this community, this group of people, is one of the most, you know, special things that I've been a part of in my life so far, aside from my own family. And if I was to get up and do something that was totally going to put all of that in jeopardy for everybody involved, and on top of that, show so much disrespect to Joe and her body of work, there's no way that I could expect anyone to feel sorry for me when I suddenly feel like I'm not a part of that anymore. Because I'd have done that to myself at that point.
That's very eloquent, John. Because, yeah, I just spent a year of my life writing about this fandom and how wonderful it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I literally have to go through an exercise or something to flush the thought of this case from my head.
Yeah.
Before I sit down to work on it.
Yeah.
Because that particular thing is so upsetting.
I mean, and let's not, I mean, it's irrelevant to talk about whether or not, you know, any peers were forced. That's because I don't think they were. I will say that I absolutely believe that they were genuine feelings. However, this was a question asked by, you know, Steve's side of the issue, RDR's side. Every question that is asked by any side of that is calling their own witness is thought out, and the answer is known before the question is even asked. So you know full out when you ask, you know, do you feel like you're still part of the Harry Potter community, or what kind of response you're going to get. And if you want to use that as part of your testimony, then you are adding that emotion into this to try to influence the judge and to try to influence your case.
To be fair, let's be fair.
Mm-hmm.
Joe knew her side of the story too.
Oh no, that's what I'm saying.
I don't think everybody
does.
Right.
At any point in time when the lawyer calls their own witness, usually the testimony is went through ahead of time, at least, you know, practiced. And, you know, you don't call your own witness and ask your own witness questions. You don't know what the answers are going to be. That's the whole point of it. And there's nothing snarky or there's nothing sneaky about that at all. It's just common practice.
No.
So when you ask that question, you know what answer you're going to get. And at that point, that question was asked to bring that emotion into the thick of this. And, you know, I can't, you know, it made the news. Harry Potter fan cries, you know, Harry Potter fan.
J.K. Rowling makes Harry Potter fan cry in court.
Exactly. So what the hell? Where could there be sympathy here from any true Harry Potter fan? I can't see it.
You know, I'm going to answer that. For me, I have been his friend for many years, and this has been horrible. As your friend, if it had been you or been anybody that was up there. But like you said, when you said you put it in the context of he is vilified now. He has ruined his good standing.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the chance, you know, I tried to the very, very, very possible to see any possible way that he has been, there's an other side, there's always two sides to the issues, there's things that have not been included,
mm-hmm.
and I have tried so long, but when I heard that, and then you put it, and he's looking in Joe's face, and he could have stopped it at any point, and there's just other issues that we really shouldn't get into, but he didn't do it, he's pushed into it, and he didn't do it, and I just, that was a hard day for me as a longtime fan to read that stuff about that. That was just... So I wanted to thank you for saying that, John.
Yeah, it's a very complicated thing, especially when it's somebody that is, you know, a personal friend. It's the same thing like if a family member was to go and break the law and then do something horrible. You know, you feel for the person as someone who's close to you, but you still have, you know, the opinion of, well, what they did, you know, at least my opinion, what he's been doing, you know, he's on the wrong side of the law. Whether or not they find the loopholes and all these Stanford tricksy guys can loophole themselves into winning this case, it's still something that is known full out that this is going to have a drastically negative effect on this fandom and any other fandom now or in the future. So there's no room for sympathy, regardless of how you feel about the man personally as a friend,
right?
As a colleague. It's bigger than that.
Yes, it is.
Well, you don't want to condone something that's wrong, regardless who does it. And it's just like, it sucks. I have a good friend who just got put in jail and like in, carted away a couple of states away, and it, like, for a very legitimate reason. And then like, mm-hmm. he needs to be there. But it sucks. And it's like, you did something wrong, and you have to pay the consequences for it, and I wish you hadn't done it. But just by the fact that I know you, and the fact that I love you and care for you, doesn't mean it's right. It's just like, it sucks. But it's like,
that's exactly how I feel. Thank
you
for articulating the emotions that I cannot express. That's exactly how I feel.
Well, this, I mean, we are, I don't think it's any secret at this point that Steve and I are no longer friends. And we were friends after this mm-hmm. started. And I tried very hard to not make this case the reason to mm-hmm. end the friendship. But in January, it became pretty obvious that we were not the same people anymore. And so a couple of people from Scholastic asked me about my mm-hmm. history over the last few days with him. And I just said, you know, that's been the personal heartache for me of this case, is that it's the lens through which it has been made clear that that it was unsalvageable. It wasn't the reason. I didn't say, oh, you're doing this book, I hate you, you know. But the trial was just a prism for all those feelings. And
I will say, though, that I'm not saying that Steve, you know, knowingly went and tried to commit some kind of crime or something. That's not
right,
what it is.
Right,
it's of the belief that the book he wrote and that what he's doing is okay. And obviously all these people from Stanford do, they don't think there's not anything wrong with it. And it's not a matter of him being a bad guy. What I am making the judgment of is that he is a bad Harry Potter fan. And he is taking his own priorities and his own success and his own book and everything else above the interests of any other Harry Potter fan and against the wishes and disrespecting Joe. So you can't cry over not being part of this fan group anymore. He can still be, you know, a successful, you know, bookseller, and he can still sell his books. And if that's what's more important to him, then, you know, I can't make a judgment on the rest of his lifestyle. All I'm making the judgment on is what would be related to being a Harry Potter fan. Because even in the courtroom, they said, well, it doesn't matter, you know, J.K. Rowling just not liking a book or not wanting someone to write a book. That's not going to go anywhere in a court of law. So that kind of opinion it doesn't work.
I just want to say, just very, very briefly, that if Joe had said to me, that book you're writing, it contains commentary that I don't like, and it's fair, but I don't want you to do it, I would fight her too. But she doesn't do that. You know, this is not the Joe we know.
And she even said that, you know, there's been dozens, maybe even hundreds of books that fairly comment, analyze, and talk about Harry Potter that are published out there, and she has no problem with it. She said some of them are good, some of them are not so good, but I have...
The funny part on the stand was when she picked up one, she goes, I really like this one, they can use that on the blurb.
Yeah, that was a good quote.
Yeah, that was good.
They're going into another print, I'm sure. That book.
Yeah.
Sorry, I know. We've been talking for an hour and 10 minutes on this, and I think we should leave it. I think this should be, you know.
Yeah. We gotta tell one funny story though.
Okay.
Oh, is this your running thing?
Something about me.
Yeah,
yeah.
Please do.
Just to end on a fun little light note. When we were talking to Joe outside,
this is my favorite.
This is pretty good.
That's so cool. You guys got to say that. Oh, we're talking to Joe. Then, right? No, I'm not complaining. I just think it's awesome.
Yeah. And we're sitting there after 2 days of this at this point, and I'm thinking, you know, all these crazy John thoughts, and I'm like, I tell her, he's like, yeah, I was thinking of running down the aisle of the courtroom and yelling, "Troll in the dungeon! Troll in the dungeon!"
Well, she also knows.
And I'm like, would you bail me out of jail for that? And she's like, you know what? I would. But let's not. That would just complicate.
A complication we don't need. She laughed so hard when you said that. Oh, dear God. And I was happy because this has been very stressful. You could see it on her face, you know. Troll in the dungeon.
And just faint.
Troll in the dungeon.
I thought you were going to talk about this charm bracelet because down and Joe is wearing this charm bracelet with that her UK publisher had given to her. And it had all these pieces, like it had, the piece of glass?
It had the little fragment of glass.
Nagini and all that
Nagini,
stuff.
Nagini, a wand.
Was the fragment of glass,
owl.
What was that, a Horcrux?
You don't remember Sirius's mirror.
Sirius, that one.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. We were like, is that your charm bracelet? And Joe lifts her wrist, and John just, like, grabs her hand and starts playing with it.
I don't know. What the hell comes over me? I mock her accent, and I grab her wrist to play with her jewelry?
And I
she will never come on top
hand,
of death.
But I used my chance, and I kind of touched it. So I touched it.
Well, I said, I hope she understands that I was making a joke, or a bad one, but that it looked like the pieces from Monopoly all on her wrist. It really did.
Cool.
It was like a car and a dog and a bit, you know? And she goes,
beautiful.
I know, but come on, it was
jewelry.
Funny. What are you saying, Lisa, that I should license Monopoly for Harry Potter? Are you saying, don't think it hasn't been mentioned, you know, like that? It's so funny.
That's so funny. You know, because it has a million times. I would love
a
Harry Potter Monopoly.
Monopoly.
That's funny.
I thought there was.
Yeah. I could be Hedwig.
Oh, funny.
I want to be a Snitch.
Oh, that's
like
funny.
A Snook.
Aw.
For a Snitch.
Ooh, a Snitch.
All right, is there going to be a rest of the show, or should we just call this a luck?
I think this might be the show.
Yeah.
I can't think of what of this we
just
cut.
Yeah.
Well,
say goodbye.
Well, I think if you have specific questions, I know that, you know, since we literally, I think, are the only...
Actually, yeah, let's do that. Let's do a mailbag next week. If you guys want to mail in some questions about what... lingering questions you still have about the trial, and we'll answer them to the best of our ability from having be the only representatives from any Harry Potter fan site there. We are in the unique position to answer some of your thoughts on that.
So how do you do this? How do you do that?
Well, to do that, like previous shows, you can leave a voicemail on the Pottercast Skype account. The Skype name is Pottercast. Or we also have a Skype-in number that I hope to God is still active. If it just rings through till nothing, then you're out of luck.
Right.
Download Skype and leave us a voicemail. But that number is 1-702-42-LEAKY. I believe that's 1-702-42-53259. Or in the UK, don't forget the plus, it's 020-7193-2872. Or, and we like this one the best, if you have a microphone and you have a cheapy little free program called Audacity to record yourself, cheapy and free, it's the best kind, record yourself on that program, save it to a little MP3, and email it to us at staff@pottercast.com. And those almost always make it to the show.
And the people can just still type, too. They
if you'd like,
email.
Lord knows, we'll probably see plenty of them in the comments to this blog on podcast.com. But we will try to...
And that'll be a good time to bring Special K back, because she's been handling the commentary. We haven't addressed at all the reason I'm not doing reporting, and I think that would be unfair to not do. There's an email of mine that was entered into testimony, which is really all I'm going to say about that.
Yeah.
Steve was asked on the stand whether he felt that RDR had misled to him, lied to him, and that whether that was the reason he was no longer going to work with them. And he said no. And then they produced this email, which said exactly that, but that it was the reason. So it was brought in that day. That's why I didn't know that it was going to be brought in. I found out very briefly before that it was a possibility that it was going to be brought in. And then I only knew it was going to be brought in when it was, because it hinged on him answering that question one way or the other, which you can only do. It's called impeachment, which you can only do when somebody says something that you have proof of the opposite, I guess. And so that's how that occurred. So I stopped taking notes, which was probably just an extra precaution. The next day I did take notes, but just for my personal benefit, which I'm going to post somewhere personal. And then I passed the reporting. I had alerted Kristen that morning that this might happen and for her to start. And the only reason, there's absolutely 100% no reflection on Sue that she's not doing it. It's just that Sue, as you've said, you have a very personal relationship with Steve. And if we're going to go to a different editor, we might as well go to one who doesn't, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you for saying that.
No, not at all. That's not at all. It's just like, if we're going to go to another editor, why head down this path again? You know, so. And why put you in that position? Like, honestly, you have to stress out with this, with all this.
We will pick this up with a mailbag. It won't be the whole show next week. We held your interest this week.
But this is important enough to, you know, devote the show to. It's okay.
It's important to be informed on this as a Harry Potter fan. And it's interesting now that this is the trial, at least the first trial. Lord knows this will be appealed if either side wins. But it's just good to be knowledgeable about this and not to be ignorant or anything. Because it will have a lasting effect on the fandom. And it could have a very drastically lasting effect if RDR pulls it off. So everybody just got to keep our eyes on it. And next week we'll come back with a Canon Conundrum.
Arg.
Probably a Phoenix Files maybe, and all the other fun stuff.
Oh, and please, before we get any more, and we were going to do something about the acting troupe. It's going to come. Please, please.
Oh, jeez, God.
Oh, God. I know. You guys, we have it all ready to go. We have it ready to go. Almost ready to go, but we weren't in trial the past 3 days. But I feel terrible because we've been talking about this since like October or something.
What did I say to you?
To throw it in this week's show would have totally lost all of its, you know, oomph. And I want to have a really big start.
It's worth having
because this
own.
Is going to be a heck of a lot of fun and very exciting, and I can't wait to get the cast casted and to get Megan back on to talk about what she's got for the script. Actually, we probably won't even really tell you about the script because we don't want to give any spoilers. You know, you have to find out about it like a story.
Tune in next week, kids. Next same time.
Yes. If nothing else, keep buying us on Facebook.
Nobody bought me recently. That's such a strange thing to say.
Aww.
I'll buy you, Melissa.
Someone new bought me.
Do you have enough money? I am expensive.
I'm expensive.
You're expensive, Melissa.
Oh, this is a bad conversation.
Maybe the winner
of Let's move
ooh,
on,
thanks.
Shall we?
Maybe the winner of the Friends for Sale contest gets an autographed drawing
of
Mr. Hammer.
I have one that goes, I object and I swap you.
I want to see those drawings.
It's bad.
Yeah.
You go stir crazy. You go a little crazy in your head while you're
sitting. Imagine him as a gavel.
No.
Oh, I'd have been drawing left and right.
You forget it. You would have done the entire trial in picture form. We wished. Yeah.
That would have been brilliant.
John started talking about, because he talks about food quite often.
I like food.
He was saying he wanted to draw, like, the scene of the courtroom, but with everybody holding burritos.
Which wouldn't really add to anything other than my own amusement.
As long as they had a glass of Pellegrino,
yes.
I would have been with you.
It's so cute that everybody knows how you love Pellegrino now. I didn't even know you were on Pottercast for 2 weeks.
I'm just feeding to it now.
Everybody's like, everybody loves Sprack and his Pellegrino. I'm like, how do they know about it?
Sam. I was just going to say, Sam, are you just admitting that you don't listen to Pottercast? It's all right. She cleaned my kitchen. I'll let her go.
Now, what's that? What did you call that, Melissa? That when you can present information
that
proves otherwise?
I just impeached you.
We just impeached Sam Freeman.
Big red impeached over her head.
You know what, you guys? Snook. Snook is when you get called out on a podcast for not listening to it for 3 weeks.
That you pretend to love.
Hey, I never said that. I said I love the people on the podcast.
I know, I'm kidding. Yeah.
Sitting in your living room, I can come over there.
Just not our podcast. I know you can.
Oh, well, till next time.
Okay, enough.
Keep twiddling those dials.
The next password will be verdict.
Keep each other safe.
Keep safe.
Good night.
We've missed it.
W3.
I confess myself disappointed.
Now, if you don't mind, I'm going to bed.
Great Scott, no wonder. Look at the time. We've been here nearly 4 hours. Spooky how the time flies when one's having fun.
This week's podcast was produced by the Podcast Trio and Steve Bonnet. Thanks to our Scooby 5 team, Aaron and Nina, and thanks, as always, to our awesome transcription elves for transcribing this and all our other episodes on podcast.com. For more information about the show and how to contact us and be a part of future episodes, visit podcast.com.
Ew, there's nothing you can tell your cauldron. It's getting all over my shoes.